All right, good evening. We got to get used to each other. When I say good evening, I mean, if you saw me at Walmart, if I was walking by you in Walmart and I said, good morning, would you just ignore me or would you say good morning? I don't know. I'm assuming you're the kind of people who would say good morning back. So when I say good evening, I mean, if I say good morning, I really mean that, right? Good evening. Appreciate it. Thank you. Look forward to being with you again to talk about the book of 1 Thessalonians. I was away last week, but I was thinking about you. I appreciated Brother Terry digging into some of this material. Let us have a word of prayer, and then we'll dive into chapter 5 again. Our Father in heaven, we thank you for blessing us, preserving us, giving us this time and opportunity to come together and to think about your word, to be encouraged by one another, to be renewed and strengthened in our faith so that we can live as Jesus lived out in this present world. Please forgive us of our sins and our shortcomings. Please be with those who would love to be with us today and are not able to do that. And please be with all of the teachers and with all of the students who are meeting together at this hour. We ask these things of you and offer our thanks to you because of what Christ has done. In his name, amen. All right, I'm made to understand that you guys did talk some about this section here in 1 Thessalonians chapter 5. Of course, verses 1 through 11 have to do with the Lord's coming. And Terry told me you didn't finish the section, so I will assume that you did cover these first several verses of it at least. But for my own benefit, I'd like to hear from you what you did think about or talk about last week, because I would do that anyway. And then maybe I will share some of my observations with you on these first several verses before we go forward. So let's go ahead and read it first. That'll give you a chance to prime the pump and allow your mind to sort of be refreshed on some of this if you haven't looked at it. Let's look at 1 Thessalonians chapter 5 and read together, beginning at verse number 12, and we will stop short of the conclusion. I'm sure we won't talk about it today. Verse 12, but we beseech you, brethren, to know them that labor among you and are over you in the Lord, and admonish you, and to esteem them exceeding highly in love for your work, for their work's sake. Be at peace among yourselves. And we exhort you, brethren, admonish the disorderly, encourage the faint-hearted, support the weak, be long-suffering toward all. See that none render unto anyone evil for evil, but always follow after that which is good, one toward another and toward all. Rejoice always, pray without ceasing. In everything give thanks, for this is the will of God in Christ Jesus to youward. Quench not the spirit, despise not prophesyings, prove all things, hold fast that which is good. Abstain from every form of evil, and the God of peace himself sanctify you wholly, and may your spirit and soul and body be preserved entire without blame at the coming of our Lord Jesus Christ. Faithful is he that called you, who will also do it. And these verses, I sort of captioned them Paul's counsel. When you think about what is happening here, you know that we're nearing the end of the letter now. He has talked with them at some length about the Lord's return. He offered in chapter 4, verses 13 through 18, he has offered them some words of comfort regarding those who had already died. And he says to them specifically, wherefore, because of these things, comfort one another with these words. And then, as the way we have it broken down, and then in chapter 5, he continues that, but he really emphasizes sort of the glorious nature of Jesus, of his coming again. And it's on the heels of that rather lengthy passage for a letter of this length. This is a rather lengthy passage. It's on the heels of that he now goes into a series of shorter exhortations or encouragements of specific kinds. And all of this is to be interpreted in light of what he has just said to them about the Lord's return. Now, you remember, the whole letter is about looking and living toward Jesus' return. The whole letter is looking toward Christ. That is mentioned in every chapter, his return. The whole letter is about how they ought to be living in the interim until Jesus does return. And we've got that long passage and then these exhortations here. All these exhortations are to be understood in that light that is Christ coming again. Questions now for you. Tell me, what did you think about? What did you talk about last week relative to these verses? You can give me any of it because all of it would be new to me. I wasn't part of the discussion. You guys covered a lot of ground. Now listen, you give me something, make Terry look good. What'd I miss, Doug? Okay, yes, sir. Okay, he says some of the things that were preached about on Sunday morning are mentioned in this text. Well, now that's a good point, isn't it? He said that living in peace is an easy thing to say, but under the circumstances of that church, everything that was going on in that church is pretty profound. And I think it's particularly relevant the context in which he says it in these verses. I wanted to point that out to you because, you know, you hear about there needing to be peace and us having peace and so forth, but there's a specific context here that I think is helpful, something that be immediately relevant for us. Rejoice, that's right. That's similar to James, count it all joy under the circumstances, right? When you fall into diverse temptations, it's antithetical. Our minds would think the opposite, but that would be a profound statement under the circumstances. All right, well, here's what I'm going to do. I'm going to sort of make some observations that I would have made if I were with you last week anyway. Not because I want to tread over the same ground that Terry went over, but it's just kind of how my mind works. These things are connected, so I feel like if I dropped in the middle of it, then you would miss something that I'm trying to show you. I won't belabor it, maybe, and if something comes to your mind that you guys may have talked about last week that you want to chime in with, I'd be happy to hear it. Be happy to hear it. So let's look at, there is some organization to the way this is all laid out. It looks like a series of sort of disjointed almost exhortations or statements that he's giving, but I don't really think so. I used to kind of read it like that, like, wow, it's just a list of 10 or 12 things, and they're just, but they are really related. The first couple of verses, if you look at them again, have to do with appreciating your leaders. Verses 12 and 13, we beseech you or beg you, brethren, to know them that labor among you and are over you in the Lord and admonish you and esteem them exceeding highly in love for their work's sake, be at peace among yourselves. Now, who does that sound like he's talking about? Those who are over you. Who does that sound like? Yeah, well, I think the elders, I mean, the preachers are never referred to as overseers. They're never referred to as overseers in the New Testament. If you look, for example, let's see, I got it there in the slide for you to see, but let's look at 1 Peter chapter 5, and I think you'll see this. There's some other passages, but this one is I think, really, really clear that he would be using this language in much the same way that Peter did. In 1 Peter 5, but in 1 Peter 5 and 1, he makes it very explicit who he's talking about. He says, the elders among you I exhort, who am a fellow elder and a witness of the sufferings of Christ, and that be a reference to his apostleship, who am also a partaker of the glory that shall be revealed, listen to, attend the flock of God which is among you, exercising the oversight, not of constraint but willingly, according to the will of God, nor yet for filthy lucre or dirty money, but of a ready mind, neither as lording it over the charge allotted to you, but making yourselves examples to the flock. exercising the oversight. And so he's saying these people are over you, and they're over you in the Lord. So these church leaders are being described as being folks who are spiritual rulers. And that's not a foreign concept to us. There's a way that spiritual leadership is to be carried out in the church and in the home as well. And he makes reference to it there in 1 Peter 5, not as lording over, right? This is not, Jesus would say in Matthew 20, you know, that's how the Gentiles do it. That's how heathens do it. Just based on positional power, just based on the fact that they can wield the pen, they can influence your paycheck. That's how heathens do it. But he said, it shall not be so among you. And so, but that does not mean that there isn't still a difference in position in the church, and that there's not authority that goes along with the position that elders wield. And he says to them in this context, you need to esteem these elders very highly. He makes some reference to the work that the elders were doing there. He says they labor among you. That would be consistent with what Christ said as well in Matthew 20. They were servants of all. They labor among you, he says, and are over you in the Lord, listen to it, and admonish you. And so that tells me that there is some degree of correction that is necessitated. It's a gentle kind of correction, but it is a correction nonetheless. These are folks who are, a Hebrews writer would say, watching for your souls. Okay? So this gives me the idea that the church at Thessalonica, though Paul hadn't been there for a very long time, there were obviously some men there who were doing this work, the work of elders. And I think that's extraordinary. I think that's extraordinary, him having to leave as quickly as he did under the circumstances that he left, and he was as concerned about them as he was. There were people apparently among them doing this great work. Now, I also want you to think about what he's saying to members with regard to their responsibilities to these men. We think about the elders, and we say inappropriately that it's their job to know their members, right? They're supposed to know their members. They're supposed to know the sheep that are among them in order to steward over them. You know, I always say the sheep should know the shepherd's voice. That's what Jesus said. His sheep knew his voice, and so they should. That's the way it worked. But look at this, what he says here. He says that they ought to know their leaders. And there's several terms translated know in the English from the Greek, but this particular one has to do with being aware of them. Be aware of these men and think about these men. You ought to appreciate them, what they're doing, the sacrifices they have to make, and so forth. It's not a unilateral relationship where they're always thinking about the members and always kind of running after the members, but the members ought to be very considerate of people who are doing this particular work. It's very dangerous, I think, when you don't have a reciprocal respect between elders and members. Very dangerous. In order for this relationship to function the way it is supposed to function, the admonishing, this gentle correction, you have to have members who respect church leaders, don't you? Because it doesn't work very well if a man in whom the Spirit has worked sufficiently that he is qualified to assume this great work, and he takes on this responsibility willingly, not by constraint, and so he's going to make all the sacrifices that are going to go with that, that'll be concomitant with the work. And he comes to you and he says to you, hey, listen, I see this or I see that, and I just wanted to encourage you to try to do a little better in this area or that area. That's admonishment, right? I mean, that's the gentle correction and reproof. If the member looks at that and has no respect for the position of the person who's speaking to him or the work that this person is endeavoring to do, you can see things aren't going to work the way they should. Something more more difficult might be required. And so he's telling them that they ought to be very considerate of these men. He tells them specifically to count these men very highly, to esteem them very highly, to look up to them, to look up to them. And isn't that also consistent with what Peter said in 1 Peter 5? He said these men should conduct themselves as examples to the flock, people who are in front of and above, certainly in terms of authority, the members, so that the members could, in fact, look up to them. And this is the connection that I see between what he says at the latter part of verse 13 when he says, to be at peace among yourselves. Well, how is that going to happen? See, how is that going to happen? Every man does what he thinks is right in his own eyes. Is that how we're going to be at peace among ourselves? Or are we going to respect the organization that God has? And the Bible says that Christ is the one who gave gifts to the church, including these pastors and teachers, these elders. And if we can respect that, the authority that these men have in matters of discretion, don't you see how that would promote peace among us all? If it truly is a matter of discretion, then it can be done more than one way. And the Lord gives us some liberty. And the way that we can have peace, tranquility with one another, is we will all submit to the men that God has seen fit to have in those offices. Don't you see it? What do you guys think about it? That's right. Thank you for that. I find sometimes that this is it's easier sometimes even for Christians, it seems, to employ this principle in the secular world than in the church. You know, if you go to work, you realize this person is the boss, and there's more than one way to do it, but the boss is elected to do it this way, and you might suggest, hey, have you ever thought about this or what have you? And the boss says, yeah, I did think about it, or no, I haven't, but we're still going to do it this way. And people say, well, that's it. If we could at least do that well, it would promote peace in the church in matters of discretion. We're not going to write a new book or anything, but in matters of discretion, we will yield to those whom God has given that authority. He tells them to be at peace, and it's in that connection that he says that. And in order for us to have a peaceful congregation here, we have to fully embrace that. We have to fully embrace that. The next thing, if there's nothing further on that, he says in the next couple of verses, verses 14 and 15, I sort of caption this, following after God. Oh, following after good, I'm sorry. Following after good, he talks about God in the next couple of verses. You see, he says, we exhort you, brethren, admonish the disorderly, encourage the faint-hearted, support the weak, be long-suffering toward all. See that none render unto anyone evil for evil, but always follow after that which is good, one toward another and toward all. And so there's a couple of things happening here. The first thing he tells them in verse 14 is that they have to be diligent in addressing sin. Diligent in addressing sin. So in verse 15 he says, don't render evil for evil, but follow after that which is good. The idea of good here is qualitatively good, of good nature, things that are excellent. Same idea, you know, in Philippians 4, whatever is good, true, whatever is good, whatever is true. I don't remember all of them, but I sort of have a way I remember them. But he mentions that, whatever is good, that's what you ought to think about, things that are intrinsically good, excellent. And so he says here that we ought to follow after these things. And I just think it interesting that he says, always, always. Not sometimes, right? Not when you're kind of feeling up to it, Even when you're under the weather, you still follow after things that are good. Even when you're upset, someone has upset you, someone has disappointed you, someone is less than they should be, you still follow after that which is good all the time, all the time. And the pursuit of what is good is what motivates these suggestions that he makes in these two verses. So if you look at chapter 5 and verse 14, he talks about addressing sin with people who have sort of different attitudes about their sin. And I think this verse is really helpful because he tells me that I don't deal with everyone the same way. You know, I sometimes used to, obviously not you guys, but I've been in churches, you know, and people would say things to me like, well, you know, we got to treat everyone the same way. So I guess Paul didn't know that. You know, because Paul suggested that you needed to treat people differently based on their attitude. And I figure Paul had an idea of what he was talking about. He was saying things like this, you know, I think I have the Spirit. I mean, he's an inspired man. So I'm just going to, I want to look at these three, and we could talk on these three things at length, and we don't have time to do that. But I don't want to look at these three, and I just want you to see how he, with the different suggestion that he makes. And I think if people appreciated this, it might make it easier. Churches are not always excited about dealing with sin. But if you're looking and living toward Jesus' return, if you know that Jesus is coming again, you have to be prepared. You have to be ready. And you can't be ready if you just ignore sin. You can't be ready. And so the first thing he says in verse 14, he says, we exhort you or encourage you, admonish the disorderly. These are those who are unruly. People who intend to remain out of order. You guys have been so fortunate as to never see a Christian with this kind of spirit. But I have. You know, a person who knows very well that what they're doing is wrong, and various appeals are made to them, and they just don't have any interest in doing what is right. He says you need to warn people like that. You have to be very stern. You have to be very firm. And at a certain point, drastic action may need to be taken, and you need to be prepared to do that. Otherwise, you're not going to be pursuing what is good. You're going to stop short of what is good. Again, much more could be said on that. You will maybe do all of that with tears, and you'll do it with a great deal of prayer, and you may do it with fasting, but you need to do it in the pursuit of what is good. He says you have to deal with the faint-hearted or the feeble-minded a different way. He says they ought to be encouraged. The faint-hearted, these are people who are already fragile. You know, perhaps it is the case they have the kind of spirit that David displays in Psalm 55. They're broken and contrite about their sin. They know they've done wrong, and they have been broken by it. Now we have a different kind of attitude. Why would we pile on to someone like that? Why would you? They're already showing the kind of heart that God would want them to show under the circumstances. They've already been sort of torn up by what they've done wrong. Someone like that, he says, needs to be comforted. I said Psalm 55, I think, but it's Psalm 51, the penitent prayer there. So he says people like that need to be comforted. You know what? You've made a grave mistake, no question about that. And there are going to be consequences, no question about that. But you know what? The blood of Christ is sufficient to take care of even this problem. And if you're willing to change your mind about the wrong that you have been doing, you will find that the church is going to be very willing to receive you and support you and help you get going again in the right direction. Right? That's a different kind of approach than having to warn someone, isn't it? It's radically different. But it's different. It's appropriate that it be different. And then he talks about people who are weak. He says, support the weak. You know, there are people who have some kinds of problems. Paul would say, You know, there were some things that he really didn't want to do, but he just found himself being, he was weak in a way that he would kind of always lapse into doing something that he didn't really want to do. And I think about people with addictions when I think about that. You know, I've known people who struggle with addictions, you know, and they do well for 6 months or so, and then you can kind of see the signs when things began to kind of unravel. And, you know, what are we going to do? I mean, this is not one of the things that I've had to wrestle with in my life, but I know that good, sincere people genuinely wrestle with these kinds of things. It's a weakness that I can't necessarily relate to, but I know what they need is to be supported. They need to be supported. Paul, you know, as best as we can tell, it never got to a point where it was not a difficulty, whatever it was, that it was not a difficulty for him anymore. But he was a faithful Christian still. He served God anyway, and people who have certain kinds of frailties, they have to be supported. I've known people who had, you know, certain kinds of emotional challenges and so forth. You know, they're in whatever kind of therapy it is that they are involved with, or medications and things that they have to take. I have a very close cousin who, you know, is a Christian, and she's got some emotional challenges like that, and she has her whole life. So now what are we going to do with that? We're going to have to support folks who have weaknesses like that. Yes, sir. Well, he says, would he be speaking about people who are weak in the faith? So he talks about that, for example, I think it's Romans 14. He says, talks about people who are strong in the faith or strong in their understanding and people who were weak. Yeah, verse 14, in chapter 14, verse 1, him that is weak in faith receive you. So he doesn't say the specific kind of weakness that he's talking about there. But that would be obviously an application. And you can see that borne out in chapter 14 going into chapter 15 where he says, you know, you have to receive them, but not to doubtful disputations, not to sort of pick at them. And if it means that I have to forego certain liberties that I have to avoid offending them and causing them to stumble, then that's what I have to do. I'm not going to allow my brother to sort of be torn asunder by Satan so that I can feed my belly, that kind of idea. What I'm saying is where you have people who have certain weaknesses who are sincerely trying to do what is right, in order for us to accommodate them, it may create a greater burden for us. But it's no problem because we love them. Jesus died for them, and he makes that point in Romans 14 very specifically. Jesus died for them, and it's no problem. So my only point is we have to rally to people like that who may be falling down because of some weakness that they have, but truly a weakness, not rebellion, but truly a weakness. And we've got to identify that and deal with them differently than we might deal with someone else. In the next verse, in verse 15, this verse I think is very interesting as well. He says specifically, see that none render unto anyone evil for evil, but always follow after that which is good. So what's he saying? If someone does something with an evil attitude or engages in some evil action directed at you, you cannot sort of recompense them the same way. That'd be vengeance, and that doesn't belong to us. But the thing that's interesting to me in this context of pursuing what is good is he says, see that none do it. Now, what does that mean? He doesn't just say, hey, guys, don't render evil for evil. He says, see that none do it. See, that's different. Following on the heels of the previous verse, he's still placing some accountability for the members for each other. If he just told me not to do it, then that, you know, I would just have to make sure I didn't do it. But if he says to us all, see that no one does it, doesn't that tell us that we're accountable to each other? That it is our responsibility to pay attention to what's going on with each other? And that it may be appropriate for us at times to sort of pull up next to each other and say, oh, I saw the way you saw the way you responded to that person. I think you want to be careful with that. I know you're bothered, but that's not okay. See, that's my responsibility. If he says to me, see that no one does it, then it's not just about me. There is some reciprocity involved, some accountability for us. What do y'all think about that? Well, you know, there's no question that going to other people, Dean said that can be difficult sometimes depending on the situation. And there's no question that going to people to approach them about something they've done wrong is not an enjoyable exercise, right? And you sometimes run into some very different kinds of responses that make you cautious about even saying it, right? You run into the right person, you know, a wise person suffers rebuke gladly and thanks you as a friend, you know, for helping them see more clearly, but we're not always wise. And I've certainly had that experience, right? You just say, boy, let this cup pass, you know. If I wish I didn't see that, but I did see it, you know. I wish I didn't get that call, but I did get it. And so now I have to deal with it. And, that sister doesn't always have the most gracious attitude. let me prepare myself, right? And so you go through all that. It can be very difficult to get yourself up to do that. But if I'm concerned about that other person's soul, then I have to do what is hard for me sometimes for their benefit, rather than allow them sort of to continue to do something that is disadvantageous for them and for others. For them and for others. This is me following after what is good. And that term translated follow there means to pursue with vigor, to race after what is excellent. And this would be a part of that. This would be a part of that. And so that's something that we should be thinking about, right? That's something we can help each other with. And you just pull up to them and just say, hey, listen, this is me racing after what is good. That's all. Just racing after what, just pursuing what is good. I thought I'd bring this to your attention, something for you to think about. Yes, sir. Job, was that about verse 22, 23, something like that? Which, 22. Jude, he says very much the same thing about snatching souls from the fire, and he just makes some distinction in how you're going to treat people. And it's based on people's attitude. That's all it is. You know, there are people who are just, boy, they're really meek, you know, and if you just kind of say a word to them, it's going to, well, you really want to be careful how you talk to someone like that. And then there's some others that I said, they're just stubborn and rebellious, and you still want to be nice, but a different approach is needed because of their different spirit in order to be effective with them. All right. Hand. Yeah, Caleb makes a good point. That's the connection between the idea of supporting someone and helping them to still do what's right, right? Not just tolerating what they're doing. Yes, sir. Yeah, and you know what? The way we, that's a good point. It requires patience. He says, be patient toward all men, toward all, and we insert men there, but be patient with everybody. The idea, we think about patience as the passage of time. You know, boy, this thing is just taking a little. But in the Bible, when it talks about patience, it's talking about endurance. The idea is that as time passes, I am under a burden because of this. This is actually burdening me, and I'm supposed to hold up this weight. And so you know that, obviously, in a congregational context, if people are doing things they shouldn't or not doing things they should be doing, that kind of creates a burden for others. And I know for me, I oftentimes feel a sense of like of urgency, right? If something is amiss, I feel a sense of urgency about it. But I sort of have to allay that in order to not put undue pressure on others, force people, right? We don't want to do that. We don't want to do that. But if what someone is doing is affecting you and creating a greater burden for you, you can see how that would be a tendency that you would have to try to force people to do things. You can't make anyone do anything. You can't make anyone do anything. People make their own decisions. And this, in connection with this idea of supporting people, you know, what if you have, I've had this happen, you know, what if you have someone who comes to you and they've come to the realization that they've been involved in a marriage that is adulterous. Maybe they didn't know it at the time, you know, but they've gotten involved in a marriage that they weren't authorized to be in, or the person they're married to wasn't authorized to marry. And, you know, now, you know, 2 kids later and 10 years later, and now they come to understand what the Bible teaches on all of this, and they want to do what's right. You think that's going to be easy? It's going to be incredibly difficult if the Bible would require them to come out of that. Now, where's the support going to come for that? For them, the parties to the marriage, for the kids, all of that. Like, if that is what is going on, the whole church should rally and support people in doing what is right. They're the financial, the emotional, just all of the different kinds of impacts that would be associated with something like that. I've seen that. But I've also seen the church rally and minister to everybody that was involved, and people who want to do right can do right when they know they have the kind of help that they need to do it. He says in verse 16, if there's anything else on that, I'm certainly not intending to rush past it. A lot of good stuff there, and we're just touching the hem of the garment, so to speak. But he says in verse 16, rejoice evermore, or rejoice always. I thought about this passage, I thought about that verse, and I couldn't make up my mind. Is this supposed to be related to the preceding verse, or is this supposed to be related to the subsequent verses? And I suppose I could see it relating to either, but I sort of have come to the conclusion that it just maybe is an independent kind of encouragement, not necessarily relating to the pursuing of what is good and correcting what is wrong, and not necessarily relating to what follows, that is, the seeking of God, but just a more general exhortation to live lives characterized by joy. I don't know, everybody doesn't have to agree with that, and scholars don't have to agree with it. That's just as I read through the text and try to see what Paul is doing here. That's sort of what I have come to. But you notice, and Brother McKee mentioned it, you know, their circumstances. Their circumstances were certainly not of a kind where you would expect maybe that they would be rejoicing. They're going through all this persecution and so forth. But in this circumstance, Paul is still able to say to them, rejoice always. And that tells us that their rejoicing was not bounded by earthly circumstances. If he could say to them that they should rejoice even when they were in the midst of being persecuted, that tells us that their ability to rejoice was not limited or bounded by what was happening around them. It was going to be determined by what was happening within them. Within them. So that's where we will. That's where we'll begin next week. Next week will be our last week. So hope it's been good to you. It's been good to me.